If it's Thursday, the Attorney General speaks for the first time since the FBI searched Donald Trump's Florida home as the Department of Justice moves to unseal the warrant. Garland also defends his agency and the FBI from the public backlash and political attacks. Plus, our classrooms in crisis nationwide. The lack of teachers is a huge disruption to millions of lives, and it shows no signs of improving. In fact, it may be getting worse. My interviews with two superintendents on what their schools are doing to keep kids in class and in small enough classes to learn. And later, target acquired. Special forces appear to have struck a key Russian military base in Russian-occupied Crimea. But Ukraine so far has been mum on the details, what we know and what it means for the ongoing war ahead. Welcome to Meet the Press Now. I'm Chuck Todd, and we begin with the breaking news in the last hour after the Attorney General Merrick Garland made an unannounced public statement from the Justice Department headquarters in Washington last hour as his agency faces increasing pressure to speak out about this week's search at Mar-a-Lago, what was behind it, etc. Garland announced that the Department of Justice is going a step further than what anybody expected, asking a judge to unseal the court-approved warrant, along with a receipt of what agents seized when they conducted their day-long search. That motion is now pending approval in a U.S. District Court in the Southern District of Florida, which obviously covers Palm Beach County. Now, the Attorney General did not divulge much information in his remarks. He was insistent that the Department of Justice would obey its longstanding protocols of keeping quiet. But he did disclose that he personally authorized the search of Mar-a-Lago and that the FBI had probable cause to conduct the search. He also spoke about the department's reasoning behind today's decision.
The department filed the motion to make public the warrant and receipt in light of the former president's public confirmation of the search, the surrounding circumstances, and the substantial public interest in this matter. Faithful adherence to the rule of law is the bedrock principle of the Justice Department and of our democracy. Upholding the rule of law means applying the law evenly, without fear or favor. Under my watch, that is precisely what the Justice Department is doing. All Americans are entitled to the even-handed application of the law, to due process of the law, and to the presumption of innocence. Federal law, long-standing department rules, and our ethical obligations prevent me from providing further details as to the basis of the search at this time.
So, reading between the lines, Garland is essentially saying that even though the former president is not some average citizen, the Justice Department is going to try to treat him like one under the law. Now, whether that's the correct decision for Garland to make politically or reputationally, time will tell, but you see where he's going legally. And filling in some of the details around what led up to the search, NBC News confirmed that the former president had received a subpoena for those documents in his possession earlier this year. The Justice Department and the former president's lawyers held a meeting about those documents in June. Obviously, the results of that meeting were not satisfactory to the Department of Justice. And during his remarks, the Attorney General also addressed some of the public backlash that the Justice Department and the FBI have received, particularly from the former president and his allies, since Trump himself went public with the search earlier this week.
I will not stand by silently when their integrity is unfairly attacked. The men and women of the FBI and the Justice Department are dedicated, patriotic public servants. Every day, they protect the American people from violent crime, terrorism, and other threats to their safety while safeguarding our civil rights. They do so at great personal sacrifice and risk to themselves. I am honored to work alongside them.
Joining me now on set is NBC's Ryan Riley, who covers the Department of Justice for us. Vaughn Hilliard is near Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida, and Sahil Kapoor is on Capitol Hill. We're also joined by NBC News legal analyst and former federal prosecutor Carol Lamb. So let's get into what we've learned. Ryan, a few of the details here. First of all, I think we all expected Garland was feeling the pressure to come out and say something. I think the surprising thing is it was more than saying something. They made a decision. They want to reveal more to the public. Explain how unprecedented this is.
It is. I mean, it's unprecedented, but it was very much so within the rules of the Justice Department. That's sort of what he was doing. He's going as far as he possibly can within the bounds of the guidelines. He doesn't want to pull a James Comey, essentially, is what he's trying to avoid here. He doesn't want to go and release derogatory information. Mm-hmm. Now, if you notice in the what I found interesting about this application that they put in to unseal this is they note that, you know, President Trump might be able to argue that this is going to damage him in some way, right? Like, or that he has privacy interests, and they're giving him the opportunity to do so. So I think basically the ball is in Trump's court now. They have called his bluff and said, hey, okay, sure, you want this unsealed? Let's get it all out there. Let's put it out there. And if Trump goes along with it, they can put it out there.
So he could end up saying, no, he doesn't want this disclosed. So right now, the ball, they went to a judge, and essentially what you're saying is the judge is going to go to Trump and say, do you want this in the public, in the public sphere?
Precisely. They're giving him that opportunity. Are you sure about this? Like, they're giving him that one last opportunity to say, are you sure? Like, there's no take backs after this. If you approve this, if you want to be transparent about this, it's going to come out there.
All right, Ryan, stick around. Vaughn Hilliard is down in Mar-a-Lago covering things from the Trump perspective. And I know you've got a quick statement from the former president reacting to Garland here. Because again, as Ryan just reported, it is now in Trump's The ball is now in Trump's court. What did he say?
Right. And actually, if I could, before we read Trump's statement here, I think it's important the context that we also just got here this afternoon. And that was that there was a subpoena issued to the former president's office here this spring. That led to June 3rd, a meeting between DOJ officials, Trump's lawyers, and Trump himself, when they turned over several boxes of documents over to the Department of Justice here. And I think that that is where that 2 months in between, ultimately that day when the Trump team willingly handed over documents in the search warrant execution is important, because clearly the Department of Justice determined that they did not receive all the documents they were looking for. So if we turn to the Trump statement that just came out here in the last few minutes after Attorney General Merrick Garland's press conference, quote, my attorneys and representatives were cooperating fully and very good relationships had been established. The government could have had whatever they wanted if we had it. They asked us to put an additional lock on a certain area. Done. Everything was fine, better than that of most previous presidents. He goes, they got way ahead of themselves. Crazy. Essentially, Donald Trump is making the case that they complied with the subpoena that was issued. Right. They turned over all relevant documents. Clearly, the Department of Justice didn't believe that to be the case and issued that search warrant.
But, Vaughn, just to clarify, we do not yet have a reaction from the Trump world about whether they're going to stand in the way of the Department of Justice's attempts to unseal the warrant.
Right. I have reached out to Trump's team specifically, and another one of our colleagues has reached out to his two lawyers that are working on this case. Mm-hmm. They have not gotten back to us at this time, and we're working to read through right now the lines of that motion to unseal from the Department of Justice to better understand exactly what that timeline is on whether they'd fight it or not. But it's important. I would want to note, though, I was talking with a source familiar with the matter from Trump's side of this just yesterday, and I put out the question to them, would they turn over and show the public the warrant and the property receipt, because they've had a copy of that since the search warrant was executed, to be very clear. And they told me that, no, we are not going to release that search warrant copy. But the argument was that because it was the burden of transparency was on the Department of Justice. So sort of essentially Department of Justice and Merrick Garland just turned that argument on its head and said, all right, well, here we go. We're ready to be transparent.
Gotcha. Vaughn Hilliard. Appreciate that reporting. So, Ryan, let me go back to you now. So, how long does the Trump team have to respond to this request by the Justice Department?
So actually, the judge in this case just now, just a few minutes ago, filed something telling DOJ to advise the court on Trump's position on it, right? So they're going to present this to Trump's team and say, and now DOJ will make a filing and represent what Trump's position is on this. So he's really going to do this on an expedited basis, 3 p.m. Friday, from what I understand. So that's like, it's going to be
3 p.m.
Quick.
Friday. Trump's response is due?
That the Justice Department's representation of what Trump's position is doing this. Basically, they're trying to speed the ball up on this. And this is the moment where Trump is going to have to kind of put up or shut up and decide whether or not they're going to try to object to this or whether or not they're going to let this go free as they've been required. And as I think it's a really important point that Vaughn had, they could put this out right now, but they're not putting this out right now. And there's a reason that they're not putting this out right now. It would list everything that they seized. It would list what laws specifically are being investigated. That is potentially derogatory information about the president that they could put out, but they aren't.
You made another important point to me about who signed the warrant. again, make that point. There was a specific person at Justice signed this warrant.
Yeah, so a top counterintelligence official at the Justice Department is the one who signed off on this. So it just isn't like a line prosecutor who's right. working on this. That's the name that's on the bottom of this. So this is the highest levels as we see.
All right, let me bring in Carol Lamb here, because Carol, all of my next questions, you're probably best positioned to answer. You've just heard all of this. How unusual is a situation like this where you have it's high profile, where you have the Justice Department willing to make a search warrant public, willing to make the inventory public, waiting for the person that the other person to do this. I'm just curious, how often does this happen?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here, Chuck. It is very unusual because generally speaking, people who have had search warrants executed at their homes are not real interested in creating a lot of noise around that and letting people know that their homes have been searched. In this case, obviously, the opposite has taken place. It wasn't the Justice Department that went public with this search. It was the former president himself. So now, as you've pointed out, Trump's team has to make a decision as to whether they're going to agree to the release of this or not. But I want to be clear about this. Although we will get some information, even if the search warrant and the property receipt are disclosed, if the judge orders them disclosed, we will get some information, but we are not going to see at this point in time the affidavit supporting the search warrant. So we're not going to see every little detail of the investigation that the magistrate judge who signed off on this warrant saw. We're going to see a very cut and dried, we're looking for evidence of this particular kind of crime, and these are the items that we expect to find there and we will seize, and these are the items we have seized, but that's all we're going to see. It is highly unusual, again, because of the particular circumstances here.
Do you, look, none of us can predict what Trump is going to do and whether he wants this public or not. Now that the ball's in his court, that's a unique decision. The speed, Carol, that the judge is quickly dealing with this, is that a surprise to you?
That's not a surprise, and I'm glad to see that it's happening because obviously everything about this is unusual. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you perceive this the same way I did, but when Attorney General Garland came out today, he was very angry. There was no small talk. Mm-hmm. There were no preliminary statements. For those who have seen Merrick Garland before and dealt with him, he is as measured a person as you're going to get, and he is very, very angry. Not that he let that get in the way of his duty, but this is really a step that the department has taken that it does not usually take, and it's because the Attorney General has had it with the attacks on the Justice Department and the FBI.
Sahil Kapoor, you cover Congress. I would argue today's statement arguably is a response now to what Mitch McConnell called for. And I'm focusing on him because he's about the only elected Republican that seemed to say something publicly but be measured about it. Is this going to satisfy Mitch McConnell?
Well, it seems to satisfy at least a part of Mitch McConnell's demand, right? He wanted the Justice Department to explain what happened, what led to the events of that Mar-a-Lago search on Monday. And it seems like the Attorney General has taken the first step to explaining that. And of course, there's more that they have to do, you know, to play this by the book to make sure that that warrant and that property receipt can be unsealed. Now, the irony here, and we've discussed this, Donald Trump has in his possession that information. And if he is confident in his narrative that many Republicans are echoing, he has the power to release it. So I think that, you know, that onus shifts back to him. In the meantime, it remains to be seen, Chuck, whether the Republican narrative outside Mitch McConnell, the Trump defenders, mm-hmm. is going to shift much. I mean, recently, the statements I've seen since Garland's remarks from Republicans like Ted Cruz, they're not backing off. He is, again, continuing to argue that this was politically motivated, even though we don't have evidence for that. Elise Stefanik, the number three House Republican, who could be in a very powerful position in just a few months, promised mm-hmm. investigations of the FBI, accused them of a double standard. And then I want to point this out as well. Lindsey Graham put out one of the more measured statements we've seen as well, but he did say that, you know, one of the reasons that this is a problem is that there's deep mistrust of the FBI and the DOJ when it comes to all things Trump. And this is where we get into some circular logic, Chuck, because the reason there is that mistrust is because Republicans keep sowing that mistrust. Right. And you know, it's kind of up to them at this moment to decide whether to keep pushing along that narrative or whether to just hit pause, wait to see the facts, and wait to see if Trump is willing to, you know, offer evidence for what he claims.
This feels like the old LBJ, you know, it feels like the Trump world operates, you know, like supposedly like LBJ did. Well, it doesn't matter whether it's true, make them deny it. And that's sort of their process throughout all of that. Ryan, I want to pick up on something Carol said. Carol was struck by Merrick Garland's demeanor. Would you classify that as angry?
Yeah, that's for Merrick Garland, that's very angry. Yeah. I think that he's a very stoic sort of guy, so that he was a little bit worked up there. And I would point out, you know, we don't yet know the motivation, but I would point out that there was an attack just today on the FBI field office in Cincinnati. So, I mean, this is something that they are very worried about. We've seen, NBC News has reported, that there are a lot of attacks online against members of law enforcement, specifically the FBI. Because of this, all of these people are stirring. There's a lot of talk about civil war, and it's all based on nothing. Nobody knows what the center of this is. It's like they don't actually know the details. They're just very mad about it because that's what they've been told to be.
It's been a six-year campaign of Donald Trump trying to delegitimize the FBI in one way or the other. That is something we can't ignore there. Carol Lamb, it feels as if Merrick Garland tried to do, he didn't want to pull a Comey, right? That was in his mind. And I'm curious if you thought he walked the line where it seemed to me he was trying to say, look, we know this is not an ordinary case or an ordinary individual. We're going to make our decisions about whether charge or subpoena or issue search warrants. We're going to do that without fear or favor. But we may change our protocol on how we inform the public because this is a unique public situation. It seemed like he was trying to create a distinction there. Look, we're not going to treat him differently when it comes to legal decisions. But yes, we are going to treat him differently when it comes to communicating these decisions. Did he walk that line well?
I think he did walk it well. And you'd be surprised, Chuck, these situations do arise where the Justice Department, of course, you hear it all the time. The Justice Department speaks only through its actions. It files an indictment. It brings a case to trial and doesn't say anything outside of that unless they've obtained a conviction or an indictment. But sometimes the public outcry or war or things that politicians or the defendant may say, and they're not gagged in any way, right? They're free to say whatever they want, and in this case they have been. Sometimes it ends up in a situation where there is such a misrepresentation out there that the prosecutor feels he or she must go out and say something to correct the record in as even-handed a manner that they can. It happens, and I think that I think Merrick Garland really walked the line quite appropriately here.
And Carol, how much would you read into who signed the warrant? Ryan was able to report it was the counterintelligence, basically. The justice official in charge of the counterintelligence investigation. Should we read something into that?
What you can read into it is the nature of the kind of activity that they're looking into, and that is, as you've been reporting for a couple of days now, most likely the removal of classified documents in an unauthorized fashion from the White House, because that's the kind of crime that somebody in his position would be signing off on. This is not a drug crime. Right. This is not a theft.
And probably not domestic in nature, correct?
That's absolutely correct, yes.
Yeah. All right. Ryan Riley, Sahil Kapoor, Carol Lamb, before that, Vaughn Hilliard. This is quite a story, and we're just trying to give you the best of what we know and try not to speculate all that much, and you guys were terrific at doing just that, so thank you all. Let me turn now to a story that Ryan was referring to earlier in Ohio that's still developing. Federal, state, and local law enforcement officials are in a standoff with an armed man who entered an FBI field office in Cincinnati earlier today wearing body armor, and he fired a nail gun at law enforcement personnel. Law enforcement tells NBC News the suspect held up an AR-15-style rifle before fleeing the field office. The Ohio State Highway Patrol, which is located in there, had pursued the suspect to Clinton County, where he got out of his car, and he ended up exchanging gunfire with the officers. Officials say no officers or bystanders have been injured, and the suspect has unknown injuries. They also have yet to release a motive, but the incident does come a day after the FBI Director Christopher Wray condemned threats against law enforcement after violent rhetoric increased online following the FBI search of former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence.
any threats made against law enforcement, including the men and women of the FBI, as with any law enforcement agency, are deplorable and dangerous. Violence against law enforcement is not the answer, no matter what anybody's upset about or who they're upset with.
Joining me now on the phone is my colleague Shaquille Brewster, who is on his way to the scene in Ohio. And Shaq, I know you've been dealing with the law enforcement officials in Ohio. What do we know? Is this person in custody yet?
Well, Chuck, the last that we have is that it's still an active standoff. They have the situation contained, so they know where he is. It seems as if they're no longer saying it's an active threat for citizens in the area. Earlier today was an actual lockdown in a mile radius from this intersection. But they haven't told us that this suspect is in custody yet. And you mentioned, this started around 9:15 this morning at the visitor screening facility at that FBI field office. Two law enforcement sources tell NBC News that a man got inside, fired that nail gun, and then showed AR-15-style weapon before an alarm was activated, and then he fled. And that's when troopers kind of stopped him about 15 minutes later after a pursuit in which they say the suspect actually fired a gunshot at them, a possible gunshot. There was a pursuit, the vehicle stopped, and then that's when the suspect engaged officers. So there were multiple shots then fired at that point. So since that last update, we know that it's a standoff at this point. They say that this is a man wearing a gray shirt. They say that he was wearing body armor. And you mentioned, and it's important to note this because, you know, of the context this comes in, it's not clear that there's a motive just yet. Nothing has been described. From officials, it hasn't been articulated any explicit motive. However, Chuck, I think you have to note that, you know, this comes as we've been seeing online chatter about threats toward law enforcement and toward the FBI. And already our colleague Ben Collins is reporting that on those dark websites, you know, I'm not even going to list them, but you already have folks in that world where these threats have been being launched from, folks saying that this is a false flag, that that agitated by the FBI perhaps, or that this was somehow triggered and not a real story. But as we know now, no motive. It seems like an active standoff at this point, and we're waiting for more updates from officials.
And look, you know, when local officials get overwhelmed, they call in the FBI. Here's a case where the FBI is calling in the State Police of Ohio. Is it the Ohio State Police that's essentially in charge of this right now?
Exactly. The last update that we got was from the Ohio State Patrol, and they were the ones who are on scene that stopped the car, that are engaged with them. But they also noted that it's both city, county, and state officials, and then also the FBI involved in this standoff right now. And I was watching some earlier reports from local reporters closer to the scene where that happened. That's not in Cincinnati. It's about 30 miles away. And it sounds like they're keeping a pretty wide perimeter from that intersection. But it's multiple law enforcement agencies involved in this standoff. And that's why that video that you're looking at on the screen right now, that is pretty much the only video that we've seen that's shown any law enforcement activity. It's because there's such a wide perimeter. Again, because active shots were fired. The man exchanged gunfire with officers. So as of about 2:30 p.m., it's been an active standoff.
Well, he fired a nail gun at the FBI, active shooter. Fascinating that this is still ongoing. Shaquille Brewster, who's headed to the scene to do more reporting for NBC News. Shaq, thank you. Coming up, panel is next. We'll dive into a very busy day for the Justice Department and American politics. That's next.
If you ever needed to be persuaded that bad things can happen anywhere, then take a journey with us.
From compelling mysteries to in-depth investigations, our Dateline episodes are available as podcasts.
Follow Dateline NBC now to get new episodes every Tuesday. To listen ad-free, subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or datelinepremium.com.
Great storytelling with a twist from the true crime original.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. As we mentioned earlier, this afternoon, we heard from the Attorney General Merrick Garland for the first time since the FBI searched Mar-a-Lago, the residence of Donald Trump in Florida. But was it enough for Republicans like Mitch McConnell, who have been asking for an explanation from DOJ without trashing them? Or will Garland's remarks today further rally Republicans who have already flocked to Trump's defense? Let me bring in today's panel for a little discussion here. Nicholas Wu is a congressional reporter for Politico. Naveen Nayak, president of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, and Sarah Chamberlain is president of Republican Main Street Partnership. Coming out and saying something, Nicholas, that was something that it felt like the pressure was building. We had a report this morning that said even folks inside DOJ were saying something should be said. This was different. He tried to create, I think, a distinction. Look, we're going to treat him no differently than we would treat anybody else legally, but we are going to communicate differently. Did he walk the line?
It's a very fine line that he's trying to walk, and it looks like so far the Attorney General is doing so. I mean, the Department of Justice has just been burned so badly in the past by the way it's made public statements on some of these investigations, like what happened, of course, with the Hillary Clinton investigation. And so now I think we see the Justice Department trying to learn from some of those past missteps and, you know, as they move forward with this investigation.
Should he have had Christopher Wray standing next to him, even if he wasn't saying a word? Should Christopher Wray have been standing next to him?
It's hard to say. I mean, mm-hmm. I think this is something that Attorney General Garland is trying to put onto himself rather than point at Wray, to allow him to take more of the oncoming flack about this investigation rather than put it onto Wray, who he's trying to, I think, show is a nonpartisan actor here.
Sarah, do you think it would have been better or worse?
Better, because he was a Trump appointee. I would absolutely have to stand there.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. That you would have been able to say, you know, and Chris Christie's attorney, right?
Right.
You know, so there is a lot of Republican credentials for Christopher Wray.
I think that was a mistake.
But Garland's statement, do you feel like did he not get to the Comey line?
He did not get to the Comey line. I think he told what he had, what he could, and then now it's in Trump's court. So I thought he did a good job. I think he did it 24 hours too late, though. He should have done it yesterday.
I mean,
I actually think on his statement, I was pretty impressed. Even the fact that he gave Trump sort of this due that, like, this was your right to release. Mm-hmm. You know, we were not going to make any mention of the search. Trump did so, mm-hmm. as is his right. And I think that was an important thing, just not criticizing what the president had actually been doing in the last 48 hours, even though at the end, I think he also made a really important, and I think this is what prompted him. The attacks on the law enforcement, him mm-hmm. really leaning into the fact that these are patriot public servants, mm-hmm. that are patriotic public servants that he is going to stand by and defend. I think the reason his hand was forced is because of the Republican response the last 48 hours.
Yeah.
That if there weren't these attacks on him and on the law enforcement, I don't think they take this step. But I think there was no choice given how Republicans were responding.
You know, it's interesting. We got Lindsey Graham's response, and I think it's for somebody wanting to rally around Trump, it's pretty measured, meaning he believes, let me read parts of it here. The primary reason for the Attorney General and the FBI and are being pushed to disclose why the search was necessary is because of the deep mistrust of the FBI and DOJ when it comes to all things Trump, such as the Crossfire Hurricane and Mueller investigations. He goes on to say, what I am looking for is the predicate for the search was the information provided to the judge sufficient and necessary to authorize a raid on the former president's home within 90 days of the midterm election. It's not 90 days. We're still not there yet. That math is off, but that's in his statement. I'm urging, actually insisting, that DOJ and the FBI lay their cards on the table as to why this course of action was necessary. Until that is done, the suspicion will continue to mount. I don't want to keep going at that point. So, Nicholas, by asking a judge to release this, isn't in some ways they're answering that critique?
Yeah, I mean, it really flips the onus onto Trump now to try to, they file in court. They have until tomorrow to say whether or not they want this motion to be unsealed. But I think what we're seeing the Attorney General do here is to try to fill this information vacuum that's developed in the last 48 hours. And in doing so, we've seen a lot of Republicans get potentially too far out over their skis. Leader McCarthy, right, said on Facebook that Republicans need to get out there and be loud about this investigation. But the danger for Republicans is that, you know, this investigation is just barely scratching the surface of what's known.
Sarah, this feels like such a impossible box for some of these elected Republicans to put in. I know what they're seeing. They're seeing all their base supporters. You got to stand by Trump.
There.
And they're not stupid. They know, be careful. There is nobody ever doesn't end up getting shrapnel when you stand too close to Trump.
That's exactly.
So what do you do?
So the Republican Main Street Partnership members, which I've talked to a group of them today, are caught right in the middle of this.
Yeah.
Because they've got a lot of suburban people that want to get to the facts, and they've got a lot of Trumpers that, hey, we know the facts, we don't care, Donald Trump is a saint. So they're walking a fine line, and they're getting a little concerned about the November elections. You know, this is not a slam dunk yet.
Naveen, there have been some debates whether Democrats should use Trump as much in these midterms, right? There was certainly criticism of Terry McAuliffe.
Yeah.
Given that Trump isn't asserting himself so much, is it an asset or a liability? I mean, what do you do at this point, campaign-wise?
I actually think there's been an unbelievable amount of alignment on the Democratic side around mm-hmm. this, which is talking about MAGA Republicans. This is much.
So you think, go ahead and brand them.
They are. Yeah. I mean, they had a chance to walk away from him when January 6th happened. They didn't. I just think the fact that this is who they are, mm-hmm. it is much bigger than Trump. Like what you hear from these candidates, whether it's Blake Masters in Arizona or Doug Mastriano, they're saying we're bigger than Trump. They believe that their movement is bigger than Trump. And I think it's really important that whether Donald Trump is on the scene or not, mm-hmm. who the Republican Party now has changed. And they are a different party.
Well, let me play Liz Cheney's closing ad. It happened to come out today, of all days. For this to come out and of all weeks for it to come out. Let me play a little bit of it.
The lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen is insidious. It preys on those who love their country. It is a door Donald Trump opened to manipulate Americans to abandon their principles, to sacrifice their freedom, to justify violence, to ignore the rulings of our courts and the rule of law. This is Donald Trump's legacy. But it cannot be the future of our nation.
She didn't plan for another investigation, another search warrant to be executed on the week that she airs her closing statement. But what's fascinating is that she's almost responding to the current events of this week, which, of course, that isn't what she was technically doing.
Right. She's running. She's getting ready to run for president.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any question about that. Yeah. And she has a lot of support behind her. I think you'd be surprised how many Republicans rally around her when this is over.
Well, I didn't see the last 2 seconds, so what was fascinating to me in watching that the first time is she doesn't mention Wyoming.
No.
Right? She is clearly trying to tell a bigger story about what's happened to the Republican Party, and she's emblematic of, whoa, if that's who the party's going to be, I can't be a party to that.
Now, on Tuesday, Nicholas, she's probably not going, you know, I have used this, and I know others are picking up on this metaphor. This is probably an Obi-Wan moment for her. Darth Vader may strike her down in this moment, but Obi-Wan still lives for a long time, right? Is that likely Liz Cheney as Obi-Wan?
Yeah, I guess Liz Cheney's force ghost will still hover around here. I mean, she's still the vice chair of the January 6th committee, which, you know, all signs point to it going through the end of this Congress into January, right? And so there's still plenty more that they can dredge up, and it will still give her this large platform, even if she does lose this primary.
It is. I go back to, Sarah, Mitch McConnell stood alone in not jumping on this Trump train. I mean, mm-hmm. it is where they ended up didn't surprise me. It just the speed. It was the immediate. Go ahead and rally around them. Are you sure?
Right.
Does anybody ask a second question on this?
Yes. The members of Main Street asked a second question because as we lose do we get back the Senate? It's very questionable now. And then the House members are all like, oh, my God, why are we doing this? Because in their districts, Donald Trump is not probably the biggest champion.
Here's the thing I'd love to see more of, though, is it was actually quite shocking how much, maybe not shocking, this is what's going on. The calls for violence that were happening, I think it would be helpful to have more Main Street Republicans or more people saying, mm-hmm. whoa, like, whatever you think about this being right or not, let's calm down and stop.
Well, here's something else. Have you noticed it's been conflated with the IRS?
Yes.
Okay, and I get we don't like the, you know, people don't like to pay taxes. But I've been stunned, Nicholas, at how I think Chuck Grassley was one of them. I heard some others who are suddenly like conflating and then the IRS agents are going to suddenly act like FBI agents when they come and, you know, my answer to people afraid of more IRS agents is, well, then don't cheat on your taxes.
I mean, I think we're just seeing like any attempts really to try to attack the Inflation Reduction Act as that comes up for a vote tomorrow.
Sure.
I mean, this was something that, you know, in many ways could be a big win for Democrats, right? It, mm-hmm. It addresses these corners of their platform that they've been trying to address for years, climate, prescription drug prices and others. And, you know, it's what can you do?
Sarah, this may not surprise you, but I had a consultant friend of mine that said in West Virginia, Manchin's not happy with how much attention the IRS agents are getting.
That is true.
That is somehow becoming the lead item that the right has taken away.
And he's very concerned about that as he gets ready to go into his election in a couple
his
of
cycle
years.
Does yeah. start in 24 anyway. Sure, Nicholas Navin and Sarah, thank you. Another strange day in American politics. Up next, a story that I'm convinced is going to impact the campaign in November. Kids are going back to school right now. But in a growing number of places, there may not be a qualified teacher in the classroom when they get there. We're going to dig into what is driving this massive shortage of teachers across the country. It doesn't matter where you go. This is an issue. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. As students return to the classroom, school districts across America are facing a major problem with no clear solution, a critical shortage of teachers. The men and women who educate our children are increasingly burnt out, struggling with the aftermath of 2+ years of the pandemic, increasing scrutiny over curriculums that has put many of them at the center of educational culture wars, not to mention fears for their own safety. And oh, by the way, there's always that issue of low pay. Nationwide, there are more than 280,000 fewer teachers now than at the start of the pandemic. 280,000! That's according to the Department of Labor. That is a crisis that is impacting school systems in both urban areas and rural areas. It's in every region of the country. Virginia has more than 2,500 teaching vacancies right now, according to the Virginia Department of Education. Kansas could face its worst teacher shortage in state history this fall. They have about 1,400 vacancies right now. How about the state of Arizona? Schools are opening shortly, and they're going to be short more than 2,200 teachers. These shortages have forced some state and local governments to take some drastic steps to attract more candidates or keep schools open. Let me tell you about Alabama. They've had to lower their requirements to receive a teaching certificate. Boy, that's uplifting. Some districts in rural Texas that are struggling to find teachers have decided to move to 4-day school weeks. Want to talk about uneven educational outcomes? Then there's Florida. They're turning to military veterans, some of whom don't have bachelor's degrees at all, to lead these classrooms. Getting to the root cause of what's causing these teacher shortages may be difficult because it's all over the map. But perhaps even more challenging is determining the effect of those shortages and, more importantly, how to fill the vacancies. Let me bring in a couple of superintendents. I've got Carlton Jenkins with me, superintendent of the Madison Metropolitan School District in Wisconsin, and Jesus Jara, the superintendent of Clark County Schools in the Las Vegas area. You guys may have two different geographic locations. I'm going to guess is that you have a lot of similar issues. Dr. Jenkins, let me start with you. Tell me the story of your shortages in Madison.
Well, Chuck, first of all, thanks for having myself here today along with my colleague, Dr. Jara. I tell you, our shortages here in Madison mirror the country as we're knowing that these shortages are real. These shortages have been coming now for some time. We go back with the number of degrees conferred in education back in 1970, 71. We had almost 200,000 degrees being conferred each year. And then now we're down to like less than 90,000. And in Madison, which we're a great city, one of the top cities is always talked about, but we too face these challenges. We have roughly 2,333 employees. We have shown as many as 571 vacancies in our district. And right now, over the last couple of weeks, we've been working very hard. And over this summer, and we have about 141 vacancies at this time, approximately.
So, Dr. Jarrett, tell me your story a little bit in Clark County.
Yeah, no, thank you, Chuck. And I really appreciate it. And glad to be here with Dr. Jenkins, actually, as we're experiencing similar issues. So we started actually school on Monday with approximately 1,300 vacant positions in our schools for our children. One of the things that you know, I continue to talk about is that we have seen in some of our in our communities that as big as we are, fifth largest district in the country. So we do have some schools that open like significantly with vacant positions in our neediest communities where we have, as I'm calling, a crisis of inequities, because in our urban core where our children need The most support is where we're seeing our vacancies. In some of our suburban schools, we are fully staffed. Teachers have choice, but we have seen a decrease in classroom educators coming out of the university system. Right. And Dr. Jenkins mentioned, as you know, is something that you talked about, is the attack that public education has been in this country for some time. I still believe, and we do here, that we are the best choice in public schools is what we do. We serve all children. It's that very crisis that we are certainly experiencing here in Clark County.
What are you doing on these understaffed schools, Dr. Jarrah? Are you combining classes? Have you thought about more free periods in a day? What are some of the tactics you're using?
Yeah, no, and I can't, I got to give credit to all my building principals that have done a phenomenal job. It's really one of the things that we're talking about is really the combination of classes, teachers selling their prep. One of the things that I do have a great relationship with our bargaining unit, and this past summer, our board approved a big raise and really incentive, not only increasing the starting pay over $50,000 a year and ending it at the end, it also increasing the column, but also, you know, using a retention and recruitment bonus for our educators, mm-hmm. using ARP dollars. But it's a combination. All my educators that are in the central office are now have been deployed to our schools to support our schools and our urban community.
Dr. Jenkins, I come from a family of a lot of public school educators, and a couple of them have already put in for their retirement, and they're not alone. And I know that's, you know, some of this was going to happen anyway. You know, we knew this with the boomer retirements, but now you're getting with the Gen X, older Gen X, or, you know, for other reasons, you know what, I'm out. This has been too hard. Is there anything you can do to sort of slow down these retirements?
Most definitely. I think our problem, first of all, we have to take it from a historical perspective and understand that education at one point, we've had shortages for a long time in education, but the pandemic has truly increased, accelerated the number of individuals who want to retire because they're feeling the lack there of some support in the classrooms coming back and going through the pandemic for the last 29 months or so. We haven't had all the resources, even though we had the dollars that are era, dollars that Dr. Jarrah mentioned there. We're talking about long-term. We can give quick incentives for individuals right now, in particular recognizing all the hard work right. they're going through. But we're calling for a federal government involvement, the state involvement. In our state, we're seeing this investment in education. We had a zero added to our public school funding in terms of investment from our Joint Finance Committee. We can't continue to do this. Wisconsin's right now always within that 1 to 3 in yeah. terms of the lowest performance of investing in public education. So to retire, to reduce some of the retirement and continue to people have people in education, I think we need to provide support, provide the professional development, right. increase the pay, not just for our teachers, but our food service workers. When we almost right. closed schools, it was because we didn't have enough food service workers. Teachers want to teach. They want to follow their passion. But it's really becoming at a point right now is disrespectful to have professionals to continue at this level and to continue have to pay to teach. It's almost at that point now. Our EAs are paying right. to follow their passion.
Dr. Jarrah, you brought up an interesting phenomenon. You said, I'm not having problems in the more affluent schools to get my teachers there. You are having problems in the less affluent schools. Are you also seeing those that have, where the parents are pulling their kids out of public schools if they can, and then that creates another bad cycle?
Yeah, we are, and that's part of where we're looking at the choice competition, and we are seeing some increase of our student enrollment in some cases where their parents have a choice. We saw that during the pandemic. And I think these are some of the things that we're addressing. So the inequities that we're seeing in some of those cases in communities, we're seeing lower class size versus in my urban core. And I think that is one of the biggest challenges that we're facing here in Clark County, Las Vegas.
And
well.
Is it simply a money issue, or do we need to rethink sort of some of the ways that the public school system works, you know, whether it's 9 months or whether we go 4 days a week, but 12 months? You see where I'm going here. Do we need to sort of say, okay, we got to rethink this because we got a different set of you know, in order to create a different way to teach to incentivize people to come do it?
I'll start with, I think we do. We have to. It's more than just money. I think that is, you know, for the first time ever, this administration has invested in K-12 education. But it's really to get us through the pandemic. It's now, what do we need to do to move us forward coming out of the pandemic and accelerate? We do have to think different about how we fund K-12 education, how we teach, and some of those things we are doing here at a very small pilot level to meet the needs of our kids. But it's the working conditions of all employees and the value that I think we need to have in K-12 education across this nation.
Dr. Jenkins, answer the same question. I mean, obviously money is always useful, but I assume it's not. You just talked about money helps in the short term, but this long-term trend and these long-term challenges, it seems to me, call for more than just money.
It totally calls for more than money. Right now, coming out of the pandemic, and we want to talk about that, we have to recognize individuals, young and our more elderly, have all gone through some socio-emotional mental health needs. These constant crises have pushed us all to a limit. But in terms of fundamentally changing education, Secretary Cardona said, in 2022, in June, that we need to look at more than just the money. We need to look at what kind of conditions that our teachers are having to deal with right now. We need to provide support for our students, for our families, and for the teachers. We think right now this process of historically underfunding education has continued, and now it's hurting all communities. I would be one to say that it's not just hurting urban areas. I'm talking to my colleagues, other superintendents who are in suburban, who are in rural, and we're all facing the same challenge. So this is becoming, in my estimation, the number one thing that we need to invest in for our defense. Public education is the key.
It's what has made us the envy of the world at times, is our amazing public school system. And there's not a school in this country, I don't care, public school in this country, who couldn't use a technological upgrade or whatever. I mean, just on that alone, there's so many challenges. Anyway, a lot to get to. Superintendents Carlton Jenkins from Madison, Wisconsin, Jesus Jara, Dr. Jara from Clark County, Nevada, of course, home of Las Vegas. Thank you both. Still to come, behind enemy lines, an apparent covert operation rocks a Russian airbase in Russia-occupied Crimea, destroying warplanes and cratering buildings. It was quite the assault. What this means for the war in Ukraine after the break. Welcome back. New satellite images shows the extent of the damage done to a Russian airbase in Crimea following an attack on Tuesday. The satellite photos show the wreckage of two buildings and six planes and damage to several other planes. NBC News could not independently verify all the aircraft were airworthy. Ukraine's government has stopped short of claiming responsibility for the attack. But yesterday, President Zelensky said the war with Russia began with Crimea and must end with Crimea, with its liberation. Russia, meanwhile, has denied that any aircrafts have been damaged and claimed the blast was caused by an ammunition explosion. But if, in fact, the attack was carried out by Ukrainian forces, it would be the first known major attack on a Russian military site in Crimea and would be a significant escalation in the war as we approach the conflict's six-month mark. Joined now by retired Admiral James Stavridis, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander, NBC News Chief International Analyst. Jim, I have to tell you, when I read everything I've read about this, I feel like I'm reading the script of, like, Dirty Dozen 3. Like, it was, like, you know, like, you could just picture that, like, a ragtag group of special ops guys figure out how to do this. Is that what we're... It almost read too good to be true. What do you make of what we think we saw happen here?
I think you've got it exactly right, Chuck. And the other thing that sprang to my mind, you'll get the historical allusion, is Second World War, after Pearl Harbor, FDR wanted to strike back. He sent Jimmy Doolittle's bombers on long range into Tokyo. It shocked the Japanese people. I think this one kind of shocks the Russians. Look, I've been to Crimea many times. It's beautiful. There are villas all around there. This is where Russians go to vacation. And so for them to see explosions and smoke rising, it's a big psychological moment. And finally, Chuck, it also hits Russia on what Russia at least claims is Russian territory. Recall, they actually annexed Crimea. So in their view, this is an attack on Russia. Your point, it's an escalation.
Would it be surprising to you if NATO intelligence wasn't helpful in this?
I would say there is a pretty open stream of intel going back and forth between NATO, United States, our Ukrainian friends. At this point, let's face it, the gloves are off. We're going to do everything to give them the material. We're also providing a lot of intelligence.
You know, it's been it feels like that this summer has been all about Ukraine just sort of hanging on while it knows that more weapons are coming, more support is coming. And it's sort of like make sure there isn't great advancement by the Russians. It seems as if we've had a sort of status quo summer. What does that tell you?
It tells me the Ukrainians are now marshaling their forces in the south, and they're going to go right at a town called Kherson, which was the first big city that Russia conquered. They're going to seek to take it back. And here's a punchline. Kherson controls the water supplies into Crimea, pretty dry area. They're going to put a lot of pressure on Putin there. Putin's going to have to swing forces to the south. That's going to further stall his campaign in the Donbass. No coincidence that Zelensky comments, it started in Crimea, it's going to finish in Crimea. That's where the Ukrainians go next.
Do we have sort of a three-month window here where things get pretty hot and then winter hits? Or do you think that we won't have a quiet winter?
I doubt we're going to have a quiet winter. There are two burn rates that are happening here. On Zelensky's side, he's got to maintain the pressure while there's still enthusiasm for this cause and NATO and the West are unified. My money's on him to do that effectively. The other burn rate is Vladimir Putin, who was just announced by the DOD, has lost perhaps 70,000 troops, a combination of killed in action and wounded, knocked out of action. That's a high burn rate when you add that with the equipment being destroyed. He's, I think, going to be looking for a negotiation sometime in the next 6 months. He almost has to. That's why what's happening now in Crimea is so important, Chuck, and what Zelensky is saying about it.
The fact, I mean, if the idea is they take back Crimea, is that a negotiating tactic? I mean, do you expect Crimea to be part of a negotiation when all said and done or not?
I think that it'll be the last thing Vladimir Putin will want to put on the table. Again, he's annexed it. This is Russian territory in his mind, in the mind of the Duma, the mind of his people. I think that Zelensky will and deserves to get all the support we can offer him. And then it's up to him when he wants to decide when, how to negotiate, what he's willing to trade for peace. I think that's still months away as a conversation.
Well, the reason I bring that up, it just sounds like, hey, look, if Crimea is a bridge too far for Putin, it's sort of like, well, if that's really what you want, then that's the only thing you're going to get. Could you imagine ending that way?
Let's put it this way, Chuck, as a military analyst, I'll tell you, it's going to be very difficult to dislodge the Russians from the base strip that they control, running from Donbass down to Crimea and including Crimea. And Crimea is immensely important to the Russian psychology.
That's for sure. Admiral James Stavridis, always good to have you on and to get your context and historical analysis. So thank you. And thank you all for being with us this hour. I'll be back tomorrow with more Meet the Press Now. NBC News Now coverage continues with Tom Costello, who's sitting in for Hallie Jackson.